Jim Mars is an award-winning journalist, has more than 30 years' experience with several Texas newspapers. In 1999, he began teaching a course on UFOs, perhaps one of the first university-level UFO courses in the country. Jim has also investigated the U.S. Army's remote viewing program 3 years before it was publicly acknowledged by the CIA and then produced Alien Agenda. In addition, his book, Rule by Secrecy, has been termed an underground bestseller. He is our special guest on Coast to Coast. See, Jim, we couldn't get enough of you when you were at the conference in Las Vegas with Linda Moulton Howe. We had to get you back for a full show.
You betcha. There's just so much to talk about, and it's always good to be with you, George.
Indeed. Let's chat for a little bit, Jim, about the JFK assassination. You've done a lot of work in that arena, this being the 42nd anniversary of his death. I can't believe 42 years already. I mean, nearly half a century. Where has the time gone?
I can't believe it either, and especially in my case, because I've been teaching a course at the University of Texas at Arlington since 1976 on the assassination. And, of course, for many years there, fall and spring semester, I'm watching those newsreels all over again and watching those witnesses' testimony. And it just, you know, it's still fresh in my mind, and it's hard to conceive that that was, you know, pushing 50 years ago.
Now, was Rule by Secrecy one of your first books?
No, actually, my first book was Crossfire on the Kennedy assassination, because when I left the newspaper business down here in Texas, I tried to start my own. And if you think you don't make money working for a newspaper, try owning one. then I decided, well, you know, I write, so what can I write about that people would want to know? And I'd been in contact with a bunch of the researchers in the Kennedy assassination arena, and I realized back in the 80s that there was a plethora of information about the Kennedy assassination that no one had really been exposed to. So I wrote Crossfire and accumulated all that, put it all together, put all the theories in there, put everything but the kitchen sink, and it just took off. And it's I'm very gratified because it's still valid today. There's virtually nothing that's come out since that book was published that in any way substantially changes the conclusions.
Of the various theories that you put out there, Jim, that you investigated, was there one that you continue to hold on to, the one that you think possibly is the one that truly happened on that horrible day in Dallas?
Well, yeah. In fact, I've been teaching that since 1976, and it hadn't changed since then. You have to understand that people, unfortunately, the news media, if and when they ever decide to address the research community in the Kennedy assassination, they tend to focus on the differences. People arguing over, you know, how many gunmen and from what locations and what were the trajectories. This is a bit like, you know, losing sight of the forest for looking at the trees. What you'd find, I think, is that by and large, almost everyone in the research community now has concluded that if Lee Harvey Oswald acted at all, and that's a big if, that he certainly didn't act alone. Well, therefore, by dictionary definition, we have a conspiracy. And most people now accept that. The latest polls show it's up around 85% of the population now believes that there was a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy. And, in fact, the last official government pronouncement was from the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and they said, based on scientific evidence, that they was probably a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. But we don't know what that conspiracy was, and the federal government has declined to investigate further or to tell us what it was. And in my mind, that's what elevates what was legally a Texas homicide into a national coup d'etat.
Why at that time, Jim, did they want to keep that quiet? Were they afraid of widespread panic in this country if it was revealed that the president had been killed by a group of people within this country?
Right. I think it goes deeper than that, George. I think that By the fall of 1963, Kennedy was beloved by the general population, and his approval ratings were around 65%. And he looked to be a shoe-in for president in the 1964 election. But what most people were not aware of then, and most people aren't aware of now, is that he had managed to alienate and incur the intense hatred of some of the most powerful and violent factions in this country, namely the organized crime,
right.
CIA, the FBI, the military-industrial complex, as General Eisenhower called it.
How about the Federal Reserve boys?
Of course. When he issued money in, through the Treasury Department, that's we didn't have to pay interest on, that really capped it off. In fact, he became only the second president in the history of the United States to issue interest-free money. And the first one was Abraham Lincoln, who issued greenbacks to support the Civil War. And I don't think it's just a coincidence that both those men were shot in the head.
No, I think you're right, Jim. These episodes that Kennedy was part of, whether they were a combination of all of them or maybe just one major factor, there's no question that it was his undoing.
Right.
Didn't he realize that he was treading on dangerous ground when he was starting to upset the apple cart?
Yes, I believe he did. In fact, there was a very eerie home movie that Kennedy made where he grabs himself and rolls on the ground like he's been shot. And I think at another point he told someone, you know, if somebody wanted to kill me, it wouldn't be that difficult. You'd just have to get a guy with a rifle in a tall building. And, you know, that was pretty prescient. But, George, I have two tidbits of information that you and your listeners are probably not aware of that I think are extremely important in connection with this case. And if you allow me, I'd like to go through those two.
Absolutely, please.
Okay. The first has to do with computer models. excuse me. A couple of years ago, Peter Jennings on ABC produced a two-hour special on the Kennedy assassination, and the big foundation of their conclusion that it was only one shooter from the Texas School Book Depository was based on this computer model. Other people have used computer models. There's even a game out that caused a lot of controversy about, you know, now you can shoot at President Kennedy.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, things like this. And they're all based on these computer models, and we've kind of gotten so used to computers now that we feel like, well, you know, the computer says this is the way it is. That's just the way it has to be. And yet, if you stop and think about it, we have to realize that a computer is no better than the information that's put into it. You know, the old adage, garbage in, garbage out. And so I want to point out that for any computer model to be 100% accurate, it's got to have 100% accurate data going into it, right? So to make a computer model of the Kennedy assassination, you would have to have 100% accurate information coming in dealing with the topography of Dealey Plaza, the distances, elevation, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to point out that years ago I interviewed Bob West, who was the Dallas County surveyor, and his associate Chester Brenneman on separate occasions. Now, these were the two men who were hired by the Warren Commission to survey Dealey Plaza in the spring of 1964, and the Warren Commission, back in their volumes, actually publishes a little postage-sized stamp of their map and a little legend, which gives all of this pertinent data. And to the best of my knowledge, this is the data that has been used by everybody from ABC to everyone else to base their computer models on. Now, here's the story. Both Bob West and Chester Brenneman very adamantly told me in no uncertain terms that the Warren Commission altered their numbers.
What?
Yes. And I can prove that because Chester Brenneman allowed me to copy his original survey map that they had done for the Warren Commission And on there, by the way, in addition to altered numbers in their legend as when it was reproduced in the Warren Commission, there are also notations saying here's a bullet mark on the curb here and a bullet mark in the street here. And he said they were ordered to delete those. And the Warren Commission, of course, never showed us that. Now, I think, you know, what more can I say? Case closed.
That's a major story.
I think so, but of course nobody seems to pick up on that. But so I guess what I'm telling you and your audience is you cannot trust any computer model of the Kennedy assassination that is based on the data as published by the Warren Commission, period.
It's faulty.
It's faulty. And if you're off, you know, on something like that, if you're off as much as an eighth of an inch somewhere, it'd be, you know, it's going to be 30, 40 feet out somewhere else. So you just can't trust those. Now, the second thing is, and nobody knows about this because this took place in Japan, and the only reason I know about it is because I happened to be involved in their documentary a couple of years ago, again, about the same time that Peter Jennings presented his ABC documentary on the Kennedy assassination. There was a 2 to 3 hour documentary produced in Japan for one of their television networks, Asahi. And they came over and interviewed me and a lot of other people. And they, too, did a computer model. And just to show you how screwy it can get with the computer models, in this documentary, they went to Poland and computer experts in Poland. They went to computer experts at Scotland Yard. They studied all the data, and they concluded that there were at least 4 shooters shooting.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
4?
So see what happens? But one of the items that they brought out in this Japanese documentary blew me away, and I think it will you too. They first sent me a copy of their documentary in Japanese, and I thought what I was seeing was what I was seeing, but since it was in Japanese and I don't speak Japanese, I wasn't certain. But then later they sent me an English translation, and sure enough, here's the story.
All right.
They found a man in California who had been a friend of Jim Garrison's, the DA in New Orleans, that prosecuted Clay Shaw, and had obtained from Jim Garrison a clean, pristine copy of the Zapruder film.
Which we have not seen.
We did not for 15 years. Okay, and in fact would not have seen it maybe even today if it had not been for Jim Garrison. He subpoenaed the film from Time Life. They fought it, I believe, all the way to the Supreme Court. And they said, no, this is a legitimate subpoena. You have to turn over the film. And that's how it became available, because once Jim Garrison had it, some of his people made copies, other people made copies, they made copies of the copies, and it finally was released to the American public.
So he had the originals, Jim, original?
He subpoenaed them, and it's my understanding he got a second or third generation copy. But with all the frames in it.
Right.
Now, for any of those of you who have seen the Zapruder film, or you may own a copy of the Zapruder film, including the latest DVD that's supposed to be the retouched, refurbished
enhanced version,
you will clearly see a splice that takes place just as Kennedy disappears behind the Stimmons Freeway sign, just as the shots were being fired, but some frames before the fatal headshot. And you will see that he's sitting on the edge of the car, his right hand's up, he's waving, he's kind of looking to his right, everything seems to be okay. And by the time he emerges from behind the Stimmons Freeway sign, he's hands are clutching to his throat, and it's clear that he is showing some stress and that he has been hit by about at least a bullet. Now, the splice appears just as he goes behind the sign. we've known about this for years, but we didn't understand. I think Time Life tried to explain that this was the film was damaged in processing. And we knew there was a frame or two or so missing there.
Right.
But nobody knew why, okay? My suspicion was that they had simply edited out a couple of three frames just to tighten up the time sequence to try to make the three shots in the 5.6 seconds work.
Okay.
But no. The Japanese, when they got this Zapruder film that did not have the splice, found something quite different, and then it was confirmed when they went to a fellow in Dallas, and he too had an unspliced version of the Zapruder film, and it confirmed what they had found there, and that is the frames that are missing are the frames that show a bullet striking the sign. One frame, the back of the sign is totally clear, and the next frame, bam, there's a little bullet hole in it.
And this
is confirmed by the witnesses that there. Several of the witnesses said they thought a bullet hit the sign. But we'll never be able to prove this because sometime, either before or shortly after the year 1964 began, someone took that sign down. It disappeared and has never been seen since. And we have checked with the Dallas Street Department and with the Texas Highway Department, and they said they're the only ones who legitimately could be handling that sign, and they said, we did not take it down.
And that would have at least confirmed then what? Two possible shooters?
What it would confirm is there's another shot.
Yes.
Okay, now the House Committee said there were four, and this bullet strike on the sign makes it five. And, of course, I think most of the researchers would concur that there's actually more than that because Gene Hill saw a bullet strike the pavement in the street just ahead of the car. And in fact, Sheriff Decker said the same thing. He saw a bullet kick up dust and concrete in the middle of the street. So there's six shots. Okay.
And it was hard enough to believe that Oswald got three off.
Exactly. Three shots from one rifle in 5.6 seconds is pushing it to the limit. Most people haven't even really accepted that, but they've tried for years to prove that that's possible. And I think the latest attempt was about a year ago that aired on the Discovery Channel from some guys down in Australia, and they got the same type rifle, but they put a modern scope on it, and they got it on a tower, and they taped it to where it was absolutely steady, and then they got these two body forms filled with gelatin and positioned them just the way they thought they ought to be, and they said, see, we can show that one bullet could pass through these two men, and that, of course, is true, but even they could not duplicate the shot that they said Oswald did.
In 1960 technology, Jim, how would this have been done? Let's say they had that triangular chute, three people.
Right.
Would they have been hooked up with some kind of radio or walkie-talkie and somebody said, go, and then they all fire at the same time?
I think that's exactly right. I think that, in fact, we had a man who came forward during the Garrison investigation and claimed that he was one of the radio operators. And we've also got a picture of a man that appears to be holding a walkie-talkie type device up to his head. This was came to be known as the dark-complected man who was standing there by the stem and sign. And just as Kennedy passed, he raises his fist, his right fist, up in the air. And a lot of people have suspected that he was some sort of visual signal man, you know, signaling that more shots were needed. And then he sits down on the curb, places something up to his face, and you can see a wire and antenna sticking out from behind his head. And, of course, if they use radios, then we don't have three shots. We have three volleys.
Exactly. Stay with us, Jim. When we come back, let's talk about a motive for the assassination. And some of the things that Jim will tell you may shock you. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Now remember, we're going to have a live program for you on Thanksgiving night. So after you have gorged yourself on turkey, just sit back, try to stay awake, because we're going to have a live coast-to-coast program for you on Thanksgiving. The clock is ticking for the free Art Bell interview CD with the late Father Malachi Martin called Perfect Possession. It is a great gift, and it's part of the After Dark newsletter. You get that when you subscribe or renew. As a matter of fact, the January issue of the After Dark newsletter will highlight some well-known psychics, some of your favorites. But you can get that CD while the offer is still there when you subscribe or renew to the After Dark newsletter by simply calling 1-888-727-5505 or go online at Coast2TO, Coast to Coast AM. Jim, in your opinion, what was the motive for the assassination of Kennedy? We've heard all different kinds of stories. I'd like to get your thoughts.
I've been asked before to give the motive in 25 words or less, so I would have to say that Kennedy was shaking up the status quo, and the status quo struck back.
And did they all get together collectively, do you think? Or do you think it was that one facet of the status quo that he pushed a little too far?
Well, you know, for years the researchers were kept divided and squabbling with each other over, you know, was it the military, was it the CIA, was it the FBI, was it the anti-Castro Cubans?
Was it the mob?
Was it the mob? And the answer is yes. Okay? And how can I say that? Because Operation Mongoose. Operation Mongoose was the secret war against Castro. It was run by General Edwin Lansdale and out of the University of Miami. And here we see a confluence of CIA, anti-Castro Cubans, the mob, the military, and there they all are, and carrying out all kinds of nefarious plots, including assassination attempts on Castro. So what's the big deal? They sent a hit team to Dallas.
How could they keep it secret for so long, Jim?
Well, because that was condoned, or at least looked the other way by the true rulers of this country, the moneyed elite, okay? Bill Moyers calls it the shadow government.
I call it the Illuminati.
Yeah, the Committee of 300, whatever, Wall Street, people who run the country. And when you look at it, there's been some really excellent work done by Professor Donald Gibson, who shows that the Warren Commission, the genesis of the Warren Commission, was not actually the idea of Lyndon Johnson, but of ranking members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And, of course, the people who surrounded Lyndon Johnson, who succeeded Kennedy, his so-called wise men that included Dean Rusk and Dean Acheson and Averell Harriman and on, they were all members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And the Council on Foreign Relations, in their publication Foreign Affairs, just after World War II, had published several papers saying that we, meaning the United States, needed to gain control over the mineral resources of Southeast Asia. And this, of course, was the genesis and the whole purpose and agenda of the Vietnam War. And in fact, in 1954, when the French were defeated in what was then French Indochina, and they pulled out, that was just within months, John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State under Eisenhower, and a founding member of the Council on Foreign Relations, went to the Philippines, created the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, which he later said was just to give the American president a legal pretext for intervention in Southeast Asia. So they wanted this war. The military-industrial complex wanted the war. The CIA wanted the war. Everybody wanted the war, but except maybe Kennedy. And Kennedy was taking steps, tentative steps, admittedly, and to disengage from that war.
Has every president, Jim, with the exception of Carter, because I think he was a pretty decent guy, maybe too nice, quite frankly.
That's why he's only a one-term president.
Yeah, exactly.
But grab this.
Yeah.
In 1979, they were getting ready to come into the election year of 1980, and all the media was being pushed along by their corporate masters to tell us how wishy-washy Carter was. And so in the late spring of 1979, Carter had asked for some national TV time, and they were saying he was probably going to announce some sweeping changes and new initiatives for his administration. But he went to Los Angeles for a Cinco de Mayo celebration, and while there, very little mentioned in the media, there was an assassination plot. And they arrested a Anglo man with a blank starter pistol and 70 rounds of blank ammunition. And then he pointed out a Hispanic man, and they arrested him, charged both of them with attempted assassination of the President of the United States. And Jimmy Carter then canceled his nationwide TV talk, went into seclusion at Camp David, and was reported as saying that he had lost control of the government.
Oh,
now,
my God.
Now, grab this. The Anglo man was Raymond Lee Harvey, and the Spanish man was Oswaldo Ortiz.
Oh, you got to be kidding
so
me.
So Lee Harvey and Oswaldo were arrested for trying to assassinate President Carter, and he quickly backed off of everything. And does that not sound a lot like what happened to Ross Perot?
Yes.
Who looked like he was really getting some momentum going to run for president, and then all of a sudden he drops out saying that he feared for the safety of his family. You know, one of the Warren Commission members said while they were debating, you know, whether they were going to have a real investigation or whether they were going to just try to come up with some scenario that would pacify the American public, one of the Warren Commission members said, yeah, the thing we have to prove is that America is not just another banana republic. But unfortunately, I guess we are just another banana republic.
You know, and it's a strange situation, Jim, because we have the appearance that we have, as Americans, tremendous freedoms here, and more than most countries. But when you really think about it, we don't. We are force-fed the candidates. They are truly pushed and promoted. You know, those who get the money behind them are truly the ones who get the limelight. So the good president, the average guy, for example, with no money, who might be the best leader of all of them, he doesn't get to the forefront at all.
He doesn't have a chance.
He doesn't have a chance at all, especially nowadays. So to me, I mean, yesterday I was talking with a guest about China 2 days ago, and we talk about the fact that maybe 1,000 people run that entire country,
right,
and they've all raped, robbed, and pillaged the resources and the finances. You know, I think we probably
The only difference, George, is that I've been to China, and most of those people in China realize that they don't have any control, and they have to do what they're told. Over here, most Americans think that they're free and they get to go vote, you know. But look at the 2004 election. You could vote for rich oil man Skull and Bones member Bush, or you could vote for rich oil man Skull and Bone member John Kerry. So
you
know what the heck?
That's right.
We laughed at the Russians back during the communist era because when they had presidential elections, they had one name on the ballot, okay? Well, you know, we get two names, but they're both run by the same bunch.
So they throw us a little congressional election every once in a while,
right,
and we feel as if we're putting those candidates in the Senate. We are putting them in Congress, and we've got some control that way, but we really don't. I think if Americans really understood what was going on, and again, I like to use the phrase the Illuminati, the group that benefits, we are being forced and dictated to, and we have the appearance of freedom, but honestly, in this, and I'm talking about not the country, I'm talking about the government. There's a big difference.
Right.
We really don't have the kind of freedom that we think we do.
No, we don't. In fact, I've traveled pretty widely around the world, and I guarantee you in many, many other countries, including highly socialized countries like, say, Sweden or Finland or Australia is pretty socialistic, and they have much more freedom than we do on an individual basis. Now, you mentioned the Illuminati. Let me point out to your listeners that a lot of people think the Illuminati is some sinister, shadowy organization, and It may be. There was a Bavarian Illuminati a couple hundred years ago, and it may not have actually died out. But my point is that saying someone is Illuminati would be like saying they are a Nazi, or saying that they are a communist, or saying that they are a Republican or a Democrat. These are ideologies, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just run around looking for somebody with a black cloak and a bomb in his hand and say he's an Illuminati. It is a theology. It is a movement. It is a philosophy. And at the heart of some of these philosophies that I feel like are negative, perhaps even evil, is the basic foundation is the old thing about the end justifies the means.
Good
okay?
point.
And so if someone is practicing the end justifies the means, then they are, in effect, practicing Illuminati theology.
This country runs on the apparent free capitalism within it. What happens, Jim Mars, when that starts to slow down? General Motors announcing they're going to lay off and eliminate 30,000 people to save $7 billion. That could be just the beginning. If this economy really starts to slow down, the economy that this country has been based on, what happens then when we have a country divided by the haves and the have-nots?
Right. That's going to put us in a very terrible position, because throughout history, when you have a handful of haves trying to lord it over a great multitude of have-nots, inevitably you will have a revolution.
And that's what's scary about all of
this. Yeah, it's exactly what's scary. And that's why I holler and scream and try to get people to pay attention and try to get things changed now, when at least they're paying lip service to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, instead of waiting until we're under an absolute police state and then have to actually have a violent fight trying to regain our freedoms.
Could it be because these people in power, who are very clever, very smart, may think, and they may be looking down road, and they may be saying, look, we're going to have problems with this separation. That's why we need to start whittling away rights now. That's why we may need to be able to force them to take vaccines. We may want to be able to quarantine them. We better get everything in place before it's too late.
That's absolutely correct, and that's why over the past 4 or 5 years you have seen an intensification of the efforts to strip away our constitutional freedoms and to set up the framework for a essentially martial law. We heard President Bush has already said that in the event of the outbreak of some, you know, big epidemic or whatever, that we're going to have to turn to the military to tell us what to do and how to do it and where to go and where to live and who's going to take vaccines, and, you know, and yet those vaccines have proven ineffective at best and downright dangerous at worst. I would point out that after the first Gulf War, you know, we had such a terrible number of our soldiers over there that came down with what finally was called the Gulf War Syndrome. And I would point out that a division of French troops refused to take our inoculations and vaccinations, and they did not have one reported case of Gulf War Syndrome.
I am told that most health practitioners are themselves refusing to take certain vaccines.
Exactly. And the thing is, here's the bottom line, George. It should be an issue. It's not an issue of vaccines. It's an issue of freedom, because they already are setting the laws into place to force you to take a vaccination. And I'm sorry, but in a free country, you should be able to say, I don't want to take the vaccination. All right? And if you don't, then that's your own lookout. If that's a wrong decision, then that's something you'll have to live with. But I don't see in a free country where the state has the right to come and tell you what you're going to inject into your body.
Has this erosion of rights, Jim, been occurring since the Kennedy assassination, or has it been going on ever, you know, since the beginning of time?
Oh, George, you know as well as I do, when you have people that seek power, they always work to gain more power and just consolidate the power that they have. So I think in a general way, it's been kind of pushing along for a long time. I think it really got moving in this country under Franklin Roosevelt, a Democrat, I might point out. And but then he had to deal with the Depression. And they came up with lots of programs that some were good and some were not so good. I think the WPA, the Works Project Administration, was probably a pretty good program because the government was paying a lot of people to work, and that saved them from starvation. And then the end result was we got bridges and highways and buildings, and, you know, we got something out of it. That's better than what we do today, paying people welfare. You know, they don't work, and we pay them anyway.
I think they should all work. If they want to get a check from the government, they should be out there picking up paper in highways. I don't care what it is, but
exactly.
They should be working.
Exactly. And look what would happen, George. Let's think about it. Think about the normal human response to something like that. You say, wow, I got it made, man. I can go work for the government. I can lean on my shovel for all day, and I can get minimum wage. But after a couple of weeks of that, and you look around and you go, gee, I'm just leaning on my shovel, but I'm only getting minimum wage. Maybe I ought to do something. So
exactly.
Then they start shoveling, and pretty soon they're shoveling, and pretty soon they figure out, well, heck, I'm shoveling for minimum wage. Maybe I ought to go get a job with a construction company, and I could still be shoveling, but I get a lot more money.
Or let me go back to school and get a new trade.
Yeah, I go learn how to drive that forklift or something, you know, and get me a better paying position. I bet you'd get people off the rolls pretty quick. There's so many things that we could be doing. For example, Willie Nelson down here in Texas has built a biodiesel plant.
He was on with Art a few months ago talking about that, but I think that's a great idea.
Exactly. So look at this. Right now we're paying some of the farmers in this country millions and millions of tax dollars not to plant crops because they don't want to drive the prices down in the agriculture arena. Okay, well, fine. Let's just stop that. Let all the farmers grow all the crops they want to. That's their profession. That's what they want to do. And any crops they can't sell at a fair price on the agriculture market, let the government buy it and turn it into biodiesel.
Exactly.
But that's too simple, isn't it?
Yeah, in Missouri, in a plant, this is their time of year, they use turkey parts for fuel. they dump them into all these machines, and they come out with all kinds of fuel. It's amazing.
That's true. When Mr. Diesel invented the diesel engine back about the turn of the 20th century, he designed that engine to run on vegetable oil or animal fat. But obviously somebody didn't like that. That's why he mysteriously fell overboard while crossing the English Channel.
Isn't that
And right after that, they shifted over the diesel engine to run on petrochemicals. And we're only now, you know, a century later, finally getting around to run those diesel engines on back to biodiesel, vegetable oil, or animal fat.
You've changed your website. You've got some spiffy graphics on it now.
Oh, yeah, jimmars.com. I try to keep all kinds of stuff going up there, and I'm trying to keep people posted on stories that they might not catch in the mainstream media. You know, a lot of people are always saying, well, you're just a conspiracy theorist, and no, not really. It's just that if you want the conventional wisdom, you know, tune into the major networks. They'll give you the mainstream news. I try to tell people the news that they don't seem to be able to get otherwise, just like you, George.
Jim, stay with us. Next hour, I want to talk with you about the alien agenda, and I don't mean those people who are flooding over the border. I'm talking about those upstairs. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Jim Mars, our guest. Jim, at what point in your career did you do Alien Agenda? Because it seems to intertwine with a lot of things you've investigated.
Well, actually, it does. With the success of my book, Crossfire, about the Kennedy assassination, as I travel around the country, I'd ask people, you know, what do you think's the next big, deep, dark, secret government cover-up? And from boardrooms in New York to taxi cab drivers, I mean, almost unanimously, people said, well, we'd like to know what's the deal with the UFOs. And I thought, well, you know, I would too, because I have been keeping up and keeping an eye on the UFO questions since I was a young guy in the 50s. I can prove that because I still have a watercolor I did that depicts a large silver cigar-shaped object that landed near Levelland, Texas. And I read the news accounts and then painted this watercolor. So, and I also wrote about it in the early 60s in the university, saying that we need to take a look and figure out what this is. It's really incredible. But what's really incredible now, George, is that there seems to be a tie-in between Kennedy and the UFOs. We now have a document that was dated at the time of the Roswell crash, okay, in 1947, and it's from a unit called the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, which when I first saw this thing, I went, oh, whoa, wait a minute.
Yeah, how did this document get here?
Yeah, right? Wait a minute, Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit? But actually, this has been verified. There was such a unit. And now that, you know, I believe on another times that you and I were together, we discussed the Aurora spaceship crash.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which, that was when you were on with Linda.
Exactly. And that took place in 1897. And we are now aware of perhaps other recovered non-human-made objects that took place prior to 1947. So all of a sudden it makes perfect sense. That they would have an interplanetary phenomenon unit. So, in this report from 1947, first off, it states that, you have to pardon me, I've got these sinuses.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. A little glass of water. A live cough on the air.
Whoa, yeah.
Millions of people just heard you cough now, Jim.
I'm sorry. It never does this until I get on an interview. In his report, it says first reports indicated that the first crash investigators from Roswell Army Air Field thought that Landing Zone 1 was the remains of a top-secret Mogul balloon. But when scientists from Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory arrived to inspect the landing zone, it became apparent to all that what had crashed in the desert was something out of this world. Later in the report, it says, with the pending approval of James Forrestal as new Secretary of Defense, it is certain that he will be briefed on certain aspects of the discoveries.
Isn't he the one who jumped out a window eventually?
They said he jumped.
Yeah. Yeah, with probably fingerprints on his shoulders or something, huh?
It has become known to CIC that some of the recovery operation was shared with Representative John F. Kennedy, Massachusetts Democrat elected to Congress in 1946, son of Joseph E. Kennedy, who served on the Commission of Organization of the Executive Branch of the Government. Kennedy had limited duty as naval officer assigned to naval intelligence during the war. It is believed that the information was obtained from a source in Congress who is close to the Secretary of the Air Force. So,
that's a pretty dramatic thing.
Find that Kennedy, of all the members of Congress, apparently knew about the reality of the crash at Roswell. But, you know, I guess he went along with everybody else when they said this is national security and we don't want to panic people and we don't, you know, we got to keep this under wraps. But then in the early 60s, there's an account from two men at what is now known as Area 51.
51.
Yeah. That said Kennedy was coming to visit, and that some of the German scientists and scientists at the Area 51 were a little bit concerned, but not too concerned, because they were laughing and saying, oh, you know, we'll just, like everybody else, we'll tell him there's nothing here. And that, but then later they overheard these same scientists screaming bloody murder because they said Kennedy was threatening to cut their budgets. And I think what happened there was is that he went to Area 51. They gave him the usual song and dance about nothing unearthly here. And he knew better because he had been briefed in 1947. And this was further supported by a FBI wiretap in the summer of 1962 that was between a friend of Marilyn Monroe's and the famous journalist Dorothy Kilgallen. And the friend of Marilyn Monroe said Marilyn was very upset, felt like she'd kind of been jilted by the Kennedy brothers, and that she was threatening to hold a news conference and reveal secrets. Well, one of these secrets was missiles in Cuba. Well, this was several months before the Cuban Missile Crisis, when we all got told about the Soviet missiles in Cuba. But the number one thing she said she was going to tell was how President Kennedy had told her he had visited a secret air base and viewed things from space. That was his trip to Area 51. And then we have a document that's controversial because there's no provenance of where it came from. It was one of these leaked documents. But it shows on November the 12th, 1963, Kennedy sent a memo to the head of Central Intelligence Agency ordering him to turn over all the UFO files to the White House. Well, this would have been tantamount to making it public since, you know, the White House has got everybody down to interns and somebody would have blabbed. So, but to add strength to this questionable document is a legitimate document out of the Kennedy Library that shows on that very date, November the 12th, Kennedy was talking about space matters and had written to James Webb, head of NASA at that time, mm-hmm. that we were going into joint space exploration with the Soviet Union and that he wanted him to implement that program. And in the White House memo ordering the head of the CIA to turn over UFO files, his rationale was, he says, because we're going into joint space exploration with the Soviets and we have to separate the knowns from the unknowns so that they won't take this as some kind of scheme to spy on them. Now, George, I ask you, isn't it a story that in 1963, in the height of the Cold War, we were going to go into joint space exploration with the Russians?
Absolutely bizarre.
Very bizarre, but it's absolutely true because the son of Nikita Khrushchev came out and said that he was aware of this and verified that Kennedy and Khrushchev had worked out a deal. See, Kennedy was working to try to end the Cold War. The very day he was assassinated, he had sent a French journalist to Cuba with instructions of trying to open a dialogue with Fidel Castro to see if he could normalize relations between the United States and Cuba. And now we find out he was going to go into joint space exploration with Khrushchev.
Okay. Jim, let's go back a little bit. And I don't know if you have a lot of knowledge of Cuba and Castro. I was only 9 years old at the time of that revolution. I had always been told that Castro and the United States they were working together.
They absolutely were. George, when I was in high school, you know how high school boys are. You know, they're gung-ho. The hormones are flowing. Me and my friends, we all talked about going down to Cuba and joining with Fidel Castro to overthrow the evil dictator Batista.
Right. Okay? Other than the mob.
And he was supplied by the CIA. We helped Castro take over in Cuba.
What happened then?
What happened very simply was that they found out he was a nationalist, and he was trying to do what was in the best interest of the Cuban people. He threw the mafia off the island, and he began to nationalize some of the banking institutions down there, along with United Fruit. And all of a sudden, they're going, "Oh my God, this guy's bad for our business.
We backed the wrong guy, right?"
Yeah. So what did they do then? They said he's probably a communist. So they passed resolutions, blockaded the island, cut Castro off from the rest of the world, which left him only two choices: dry up, blow away, or deal with the Soviets. Well, he began to deal with the Soviets, and this cry of communists became a self-fulfilling prophecy. See, we told you he was a communist. He's dealing with the Russians. Well, yeah, we forced him into it.
And Che Guevara was working with Castro at the time, wasn't he?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And he was another just, you know, starry-eyed socialist idealist. You know, they were just, they had seen what our form of capitalism had done to their island.
See, I knew that at one time we were helping and supporting him, and then all of a sudden the whole thing flip-flopped.
Exactly. We more or less got him into office, and then when he started doing things that went contrary to the neo-colonial policy, foreign policy that we wanted, then he became anathema, and they turned on him, just like we did Saddam Hussein. You know, he fought that 8-year war with Iran on our behalf, and then the worst thing they've tagged him with was gassing the Kurdish people, but who sold him the gas? We did. You know, he was a 2-bit, 10-horn dictator, but he was our 2-bit, 10-horn dictator until he defaulted on his international bank loans, and that's when he became the new Hitler.
Oh, same thing with Manuel Noriega in Panama.
Exactly. And it's really funny because drugs fits in there, too. Manuel Noriega was simply charging too much corrupt money, and he was clogging up the drug routes. A year after our invasion of Panama, and it was ostensibly we went down there to grab Noriega, who we claimed all of a sudden, even though he was our guy, we put him into office, we armed him, we supplied him, and then all of a sudden we claimed he's a big drug dealer. And we ran down there, and we invaded the country, and we got him. And yet, a year later, according to U.S. News and World Report, there was 3 times more drugs flowing through Panama than when he had been in power.
Oh, I tell you what, though, Jim, the greatest story never told is the fact that he is, I believe, in a federal prison in Marion, Illinois, and nobody, not you, not me, nobody can get to this guy to do an interview with him.
You can't get to him, and in fact, what I think is the greatest travesty of justice in the world was when he was brought up here and put on trial for these drug charges, the federal judge in charge said he could not bring up anything having to do with the U.S. government, which means he couldn't defend himself saying I was only doing what they told me to do.
Can you imagine the kind of interview he'd in the names?
Oh, yeah.
That he,
yeah.
Oh. Because but, he was involved in that bank scandal. What was the name of that?
BCCI?
Yeah, that's it. He was part of that, too.
That's right. And who was at the heart of the BCCI bank scandal? The Bush family. Same way with the savings and loan. I mean, you know, this is the same old gang. In fact, let me tell you, let's go back. Let me give you, your listeners a little bit of history. The one thing Richard Nixon did that everybody almost universally gave him good credit for was the fact that he opened diplomatic relations with China. Well, that was not lost on him. So the next thing you know, he makes a trip to Russia, and he comes back talking about, quote, detente.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He was going to reach an agreement with Russia. He, too, saw his claim to fame and history if he could end the Cold War. But it didn't happen for 2 reasons. One, he got caught up in Watergate and was forced to resign or face impeachment. And by the way, that would have brought out too many ugly details, such as in the Watergate tapes, if you'll recall, he was always talking about the whole Bay of Pigs thing. In fact, he ended up paying $2 million in hush money to E. Howard Hunt, one of the Watergate burglars, because he said, we don't want to break open the whole Bay of Pigs thing. Well,
strangely, Jim, had Watergate not occurred, he would have been perceived as one of the best presidents we ever had.
That is very possibly true. But I believe it was H.R. Haldeman wrote a book, and he said he finally came to understand, that was one of Nixon's top aides, and he finally came to understand, and when Nixon was talking about the whole Bay of Pigs thing, he was actually referring to the Kennedy assassination.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yes. So Watergate drove Nixon out, and he appointed Gerald Ford to take his place, who served
And Ford, of course, replaced Agnew first.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then he appointed him president, so he became our only unelected president. And so Gerald Ford named Dick Cheney as his chief of staff and Donald Rumsfeld as his secretary of defense. And these two guys said, no, 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 we can't end the Cold War because the Soviets have hidden weapons of mass destruction. And there was a little bit of a scandal at the time because the CIA said, well, how do you know that? We don't know that. And they said, well, we have, you know, secret sources of information.
You think they made that up?
Well, in the light of history, of course they made it up. Yeah. There weren't, you know, that wasn't true. But it kept the Cold War going. It kept the war machine, you know, cranking out those profits.
So fear and, these fear
the
and panic.
These two guys who then later told us we have to, they led the charge saying we had to invade Iraq because they had weapons of mass destruction. And that turned out to be bogus. And now these are the same two guys that are telling us we're probably going to have to invade Iran. Why? Because they're working on weapons of mass destruction. I mean, you know, how many times do these guys have to be proven wrong before people start going, wait a minute?
And one of them has stock in a company that's going to make zillions with this flu vaccine.
Exactly. And it was Rumsfeld, as head of Merck Pharmaceuticals, who pushed through aspartame through Congress, even over the objections of federal certification officers. And now there's a growing awareness and a growing scandal about how aspartame changes to formaldehyde in your system. And over a period of time, you know, it'll just break down the immunization system and cause all kinds of problems.
Isn't formaldehyde used to embalm people?
Exactly. And
I don't know why I'm laughing.
I should be crying. It's the clincher. You know, they say the pharmaceutical people, the aspartame is a sweetener that they put in diet soft drinks. Okay, if you're drinking Diet Coke or Diet Dr. Pepper, Diet 7-Up, you're probably drinking aspartame. And they say, well, it's okay. It's safe, you know, unless
in moderate consumption, right?
Yeah, it's okay unless it reaches temperatures of about 97 degrees, in which case the molecular chain changes form and it turns into formaldehyde.
But, Jim, the body's 98.6.
Oh, hey, that's right. So there you go. It's the whole thing's just really amazing, you know. But that's what happens when people put their faith in what people tell them.
When are people going to say, we've had enough? You know, we've had enough of deception.
That's a good question. Apparently nobody's prepared to say I've had enough. It's like, do it to me some more.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Then you also understand, back to the UFO thing, that it was Nixon who, according to his first wife and a fellow named Larry Warren and two or three other people, confided to these close friends and people he met that it was Nixon who took Jackie Gleason to an air base and showed him aliens.
And Gleason, apparently, Jim, was never the same after that.
That's right. It shook him to the core.
Stay with us. Hold that thought. We'll be back with you in a moment. We'll take this quick break. We'll come right back with you, Jim Mars. Hey, Jim, pick up that story with Nixon and Gleason again, and then you can go on from there.
Right. Gleason told several acquaintances that he had been taken to a secret air base by his buddy, President Nixon, and shown aliens and spacecraft.
And I think it was Homestead, right?
Was quite the same. That really changed his world. What I was going to mention, though, was we'd mentioned Gerald R. Ford, our only unelected president, and you correctly pointed out that he had been appointed by Nixon to take Spiro Agnew's place as vice president. And then, of course, when Nixon resigned and Gerald Ford became president, Gerald Ford, of course, had already earned his stripes in government cover-up by being on the Warren Commission. He was the commissioner who heard more testimony than any other, and it's also now been established that he was a snitch on the Warren Commission to the J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. So he already had pretty well proven himself in cover-up, and therefore it was really interesting. In 1966 at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, the college dean and the local civil defense director and 87 co-eds had a UFO experience, and they watched this thing cavort around for almost 4 hours. And Project Blue Book sent an investigator up there, and he held a press conference and said, well, what they saw was swamp gas.
Oh, that was Hynek, wasn't it?
That was Hynek before he shifted, before
he became a believer.
Kind of closet and said, now, listen, they've been telling me to say all this stuff, but there's really something going on.
Yep.
So that so incensed the good citizens of Michigan that they prevailed on their representative, Gerald R. Ford, who wrote a letter to the Armed Services Committee stating, quote, in the firm belief that the American public deserves a better explanation than has thus far been given by the Air Force, I strongly recommend that there is a committee to investigate the UFO phenomena. And so it did, in fact, result in a hearing by something called the Rivers Committee in April of 1966. And although literally hundreds, if not thousands, of UFO witnesses, along with scientists, pilots, officers of the various UFO organizations, conversant with some of the best cases, could have been called to this testimony, the committee restricted testimony to only three representatives of the Air Force, none of whom had ever claimed to have seen a UFO. And Ford never said anything about that, and, of course, he went on to be selected vice president and then became our only unelected president. Was it because he had covered up the UFO question so well?
And then defeated by Carter, right?
Yes. Yep. But now, I've got to share with you and your audience probably the weirdest case that I've ever come across, and this is going to be so cool.
All right.
I am co-producing a documentary for the Discovery Channel called X-Ops.
X-Ops, okay.
X-Ops. And what we do is we have an incredible team of balance between scientific types and psychics and even an Indian shaman. And we go out, and instead of just reporting on UFO stories or ghost stories or Bigfoot stories or whatever, we go out with this team and we try to penetrate to the truth. Okay? And the first one, I just got back from New Mexico, and the first investigation that this group has undertaken was due to a story I stumbled across some time back there in Roswell, when I was actually doing a documentary on something entirely different, but I needed a old-looking medical facility, and I found it at the New Mexico Rehabilitation Center. And while I was there arranging to see if we could shoot some tape there, the assistant to the director said, well, yes, certainly. And she was just delightful. She was so cooperative.
Yeah.
Said, go up on the second floor down that long hallway, and said, just do what you want to up there. Said, we mostly use that area for storage. And then she had to add, the staff doesn't like to go up there.
So they send you, right?
Yeah, they got me going. You know, my journalistic hackles went up, and I said, well, why not? And I began to hear this story, and George, I couldn't believe my ears. And over the days that we were shooting there, I went and talked to switchboard operator and the nurses and the computer systems and that analyst and even maintenance people. And the story was that hallway was haunted, okay? But then I finally met one of the nurses who had actually seen this apparition. I mean, George, you probably realize that, and I certainly do as an old police reporter, that you can go to almost any hospital and you can probably find a ghost story there. Okay?
Absolutely. There's something somewhere in that facility that somebody will tell you something.
That's right. So I thought this was really interesting, but what I found out blew my mind. When I finally talked to one of the nurses who'd seen this thing, she said, well, it's not human. It's only about 4 foot tall and with a great big head and big dark eyes and kind of this silvery suit type thing.
Ooh.
I'm going, holy cow. It sounds like an alien.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like a ghost.
It sounds like an alien. So then it gets better. I got to checking, and I found out that up until the time the base was closed, that this medical facility, now run by the state of New Mexico, had been the base hospital for Walker Air Force Base there at Roswell.
And oh, no.
And it was built about 1950, so I went back and got the original plans, and what I find out, this wing of the hospital was built over the exact spot of the old wooden base hospital of Roswell Army Air Field.
Where they may have taken those alien bodies.
Where they claimed that the alien bodies were taken. So there's an alien ghost in Roswell.
That's
now,
a great
story.
Now,
we went with the team, and we took plasma detectors and heat sensors and infrared, and we took everything, and we took some well-credentialed psychics, this Indian shaman who comes from that very area and knows that the Native Americans there have stories about encounters with these space visitors that go back hundreds of years, if not thousands. And we were determined to find out the truth, what was really going on there. And I'm going to titillate you with this. And I'm not going to tell you what we found, but I want to tell you, we found stuff, and it was not nothing there. It was absolutely incredible. So just keep your eyes open for the first report from the ex-ops.
I love that. I'm very interested in the shaman, in the fact that they have talked about alien visitations hundreds of years ago in that general region. So when they probably heard about the Roswell story, Jim, they weren't surprised, were they?
No, not really. In fact, it's interesting if you go and really start talking to those people, and you're not making any judgments, and you're just being open and honest with them, you have to pry some of this stuff out of them. But yes. They've known about this for a long, long time.
I think beyond just these kinds of stories and cases, one of the biggest boosts to the very strong possibility of alien visitations, I think, and you just touched on it, was when Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who head up Project Blue Book, switched his allegiances from whatever the Air Force wanted him to say to the fact that he believed that we were being visited. And I think that's a tremendous story that most major media never picked up on. I mean,
no.
Here's a guy who was employed by the government to investigate UFOs, who was the biggest debunker, and he changed him, and he became probably the biggest supporter of visitation.
Absolutely. And you know what? I met Dr. Hynek, and I interviewed him years ago, and that was after he had made his flip over.
And swamp gas.
Yeah. The thing is, he was hired to debunk UFOs, and it finally just got to him because he would go out and investigate, and he would find out there was really something there and something going on. And it finally, he just said, you know, I'm sure he said to himself, I can't do this. I've got to tell the truth. And you're right. When he was the government's foremost debunker, he got all the press in the world. But when he changed and said, wait a minute, folks, you know, there really is something there, all of a sudden, you know, they dropped him like a hot potato. Nobody wanted to quote him. I happened to interview him for the newspaper I was working for in West Texas, and he was very outspoken.
He wrote the book, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, that Steven Spielberg turned into the movie and even gave him a little part of it.
You know, right. He actually shows up in that movie, doesn't he?
Holds on, you know, he's got his pipe in his hand and puts it in his mouth, and that was his scene. But he wrote that book.
Exactly. Now, of course, you know, we've talked about on Coast to Coast before the story I investigated in Montana, The Secret of Red Gate. And that's available. That documentary is that won an award is still available both on my website, jimmars.com, and on The Secrets of Red Gate.
Tell us about that again, Jim.
Well, that was simply the fact that we went up to Montana to a little bitty town of 3,000 people, And we managed to get more than two dozen signed releases and interviewed people who had all had encounters or some kind of stories with UFOs. And what we did there was kind of a forerunner to what we're doing with the X-Ops, which is we not only got their conscious memories of their encounters, but then we had several of them undergo hypnosis, and we drew more information out under hypnosis, and then we subjected them to lie detectors, and that was interesting because not one of the people that we had take a lie detector test showed any signs of deception. Whatever it was, they truly believed it. And then we had eight tested remote viewers take a look at what had happened up there, and the results were quite astounding. In fact, I'm still just blown away when, for example, one woman and her brother told about when they were children there outside of the little town of Deer Lodge that they had gone into the nearby woods and played with their little gray friends, okay? And so... And so the brother still consciously remembers that, and he was kind of upset that the sister didn't remember it because he said, well, you were there. In fact, you hogged the conversation, you know.
That's great.
But it all came out, the sister's memory came out under hypnosis. But then we turned to the remote viewers, and grab this. This is the way it went. One person knew that we wanted to find out what happened to the two children in 1950. And so that was basically the question that we wanted the remote viewers to answer. But as you well know, you don't ask that question because then you're kind of leading them. They know mm-hmm. what you want. They might just conjure up anything. So he changed it into a coordinate number. He sent that number to another person who had no idea of what we were doing, what the question was or anything. All he had was the number. He passed it on to a third person who did not know what was involved or what the question was. He only had this coordinate number, which represented the question. Then he parceled out this number, the target number, to eight separate remote viewers who lived in different cities and different states. They're scattered all around the country. And they all did a remote viewing session based on this number. And they came back, and as you would expect from eight separate witnesses, there were varying degrees of detail, but all eight said these were two children who went in the woods near their home and met with aliens.
That
just blew me away. How could they have known that if there was nothing to it?
You kind of remind me of the modern-day Frank Edwards. Remember him?
Yes,
one of the great old... great old journalists of his time investigating UFOs. He was one of the best.
That's right. And just think how far we've come, George. Back in the 50s, you know, the burning question among the researchers into UFOs was, do they come from Mars or do they come from Venus? And then by the 60s and 70s and 80s, we'd gotten a little more sophisticated, and the question became... do they come from Alpha Centauri or Zeta Reticula 4, you know? And today, we've even gotten more sophisticated. And now the question has become, do they come from another galaxy? Do they come from another time? Do they come from another dimension? And so as we've progressed along, we've also learned more and more about how they operate. And we're talking about electromagnetic fields of energy. And here's one for you, George. You've always heard the UFO stories that the UFO comes over and people's cars stop, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And then they go away and they start up again, right?
Yep.
Okay, but have you ever heard anybody say that when the UFO went away, the starter came on and went, and it starts up again? No. The starter doesn't start.
No. That's true. The car just goes on again.
Now, how can it do that?
I don't know.
It does that because when it enters the electromagnetic field of the UFO, gravity stops, time stops, and those pistons you know, in the vowels, they just kind of, they just stop. And then when the feel goes away, it fires and it goes and
pick
the engine,
up again.
The engine continues running.
Suspended in time.
Exactly. And that also accounts for the missing time. Because to the people in the field, things are still going on, or they're still sleeping, or whatever they're doing. But outside the field, time is moving right on along. And that's why I heard on one of your promos, you said you've had the experience of going from point A to point B and not really understanding how you got there because the time was all off.
Exactly. A couple miles. Of course, that truck driver in that promo, 150 miles and didn't know where he went.
With a load of dynamite? Oh, my God. I hope he didn't come by my place.
of everything you've investigated, everything, I'm talking about rule by secrecy, crossfire, the Kennedy assassination, UFOs. What's the one thing that keeps coming up as a common denominator there, Jim?
Oh, excuse me. There I go again. I think the common denominator actually can be found detailed in my book, Rule by Secrecy. And the common denominator is a handful of people who are attempting to control and rule this world. And as a result, they have got to keep certain things under wraps. For example, I don't think they care if we know that there are space aliens out there. What they care about is that if we know that there is space aliens out there, then we know that there is alternative technologies out there, and that would undermine their monopolies over petrochemicals and energy and transportation and pharmaceuticals and communications and all like that. And this, to me, George, is the biggest conspiracy going on in the world today. I just read the number yesterday. Every day, 6 million children die of hunger around the world.
Oh,
now, that's unconscionable.
That's sad. That's
unconscionable.
Jim,
and how could that be? You don't want that. I don't want that. And you know also, George, that we have the technology available to us today. That doesn't have to be that way.
That's true. Stay with us, Jim. Back in a moment. Phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Jim, I know you believe that the crazed fundamentalists had something to do with 9/11, but do you believe there's a bigger agenda here?
Oh, absolutely. As you probably are aware, I urged caution the day after 9/11, saying that I agreed that we had to find out who was responsible for that heinous crime and see that they were punished. But I said, look, we've been fooled too many times in the past. For example, right after 9/11, a lot of commentators were comparing the 9/11 attacks to the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, which put us into World War II. And actually, it was a very apropos comparison, but not for the reason that most people think. Most people think, yes, it was another dastardly sneak attack. No, the reason that they are so similar is that it is now beyond dispute that certain people in high office in Washington knew that Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked, and they allowed it to happen to further their political agenda, which was to get United America into the war. And I'm not even going to make a judgment on that. I think it was necessary to stop the Nazis, and it was necessary to stop the Japanese imperialists. But and I also understand and would agree that if President Roosevelt had simply said, okay, we've got to enter the war, that the nation was predominantly isolationist, and they would not have gone along with it, and it would have been much worse even than the division that occurred during the Vietnam War.
And that, in the fact that technology wasn't nearly what it is today, Jim, when you talk about time and space, back in the 1940s, Europe was a long ways away.
Right.
Today, it's pretty close.
Today, it's it's a plane flight. You could get there inside a day. Exactly. So it was the same thing. 9/11 occurred, and it satisfied the agenda of a lot of different people. For example, Dick Cheney, when he was Secretary of Defense under the first Bush, Bush back in 92, issued a defense guidance policy paper that called for increased U.S. military presence in the Middle East so we could gain control over the oil supply, and the invasion of Afghanistan and regime change in Iraq. But the communism had just collapsed, and everybody just thought he was a war hawk, and they didn't pay much attention to him. And then in September of 2000, we find that Cheney was a member, along with many of the soon-to-be members of the Bush administration, of a neocon think tank called the Project for a New American Century. And in September 2000, they issued a position paper called Rebuilding America's Defenses in the New Century, and they echoed Cheney's call for increased military presence in the Middle East, gain control over the oil, invasion of Afghanistan, and regime change in Iraq. But whoever authored that paper was pretty honest about it and said this would was going to be hard to sell to the American public unless there was a catalyzing and catastrophic event like Pearl Harbor. Well, a year later, they got it.
And they did.
And it certainly accomplished their aims and purposes. Now,
what lucky timing for them, huh?
Huh?
What lucky timing for them,
yeah,
Jim.
Yeah, how convenient. Now, the yes, you're right. I don't claim that there's not Muslim extremist terrorists out there. Of course there are. But I believe that if that was just the end of it, they can be caught. They can be tracked. I mean, my God, they can find... you know, we have satellite photography now so good that they can read the label of a beer can that a guy's holding in his hand standing in his large yard of Los Angeles, California. They can read that from space. We can read license numbers. They can keep up with anybody and everybody, but we can't seem to know what these terrorists are doing. In fact, that has been shown to be simply false when some of our leaders have said, oh, how could we have ever known they were going to hijack airplanes and fly them into buildings? Well, excuse me, in 1995 they busted an Al-Qaeda cell in the Philippines, and they got the plans for Operation Bojinka, which called for that exact same thing. Said, we're going to hijack airplanes, and we're going to fly them into prominent structures, and specifically named was the World Trade Center.
Well, go ahead, Jim. I'm sorry.
Well, now it's come out recently that there was a secret military intelligence unit within the Pentagon that identified Mohammed Atta as an Al-Qaeda member and, you know, placed him in there a year before 9/11. And so what it boils down to is that either we had the most incompetent people ever in office, which I don't buy, or they were somehow complicit in allowing this to happen. And the key thing on 9/11 is the war game exercises. This has still not been brought out to the majority of the American people. And the 9/11 Commission only mentioned Vigilant Guardian, I think, in a footnote. And yet several people within NORAD, within the FAA, when they were told that there were hijacked airplanes, their first response was, well, is this real life or is this the war games? They had war games going on that morning simulating, in some instances, hijacked airplanes. It's been reported that there were 22 blips on FAA radar screens that were false images. This was software images simulating hijacked airplanes. And this is why, because of these war games, that our normal security was in disarray. Fighter interceptors were sent out over the Atlantic and up into Canada. The FAA wasn't sure what was a real hijacked airplane and what was a phony one. And good Lord, now the question becomes, that's how the real hijackers were able to bypass our normal air defense. And yet, how did they know when to coordinate their attack with these war games? the National Security Agency had intercepted a message from Mohammed Atta the day before, September the 11th, and he was saying the match is about to begin. Tomorrow is zero hour.
Did you hear that Bin Laden was once called? He used the name Tim Osman.
Yes, that's all in my book, Inside Job.
That's where it came from.
Exactly. And so how did they know when to coordinate this attack without inside information?
Yeah.
It was an inside job, okay? And one of the key tip-offs to me is that somebody should have taken the heat for 9/11. Somebody should have been fired. Somebody should have been demoted. Somebody should have been moved aside or something, but no one, not one person, was ever punished or even called on the carpet for the failure on 9/11, and that's because everybody was doing exactly what they were supposed to.
Listen to this paragraph. He was a 27-year-old Saudi. Tim Osman has recently become better known as Osama bin Laden. Tim Osman was the name assigned to him by the CIA for his tour of the United States and U.S. military bases in search of political support and armaments.
That's exactly right. That was the code name that he traveled under when he came over here to get money and support from the CIA to go back and create Al-Qaeda.
And this that was, just doesn't make sense. There's just too much. There is no arm's length relationships with any of these people.
No.
They all knew each other.
Exactly. And, in fact, in the summer of 2000, the Bush family traveled to Saudi Arabia as the guest of the Saudi royals and of the bin Laden family in particular. And you know what? And then after 9/11, when none of us could fly, the bin Laden, about 40 Saudis, actually it was more than 40, about 150 Saudis and about 40 bin Laden's family was allowed to fly and gather at certain airports so that they could get out of the country.
There's reports that bin Laden, under the name of Tim Osman, also visited the White House.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Unbelievable.
It's absolutely incredible, you know. And the thing is, think about it, George. Al-Qaeda was created by the CIA. In fact, my sources tell me that the name Al-Qaeda, we know, means the base. And I always assumed that just meant, well, that's their home base, you know, their home headquarters or their base of operations. But I've been told, no, that refers to the CIA's computer database of Arab mercenaries that they can reach into and pull out a guy and tell him to go do anything they want to tell him to do. And, of course, that raises the question is, well, then who was really giving Al-Qaeda their orders? And this has never been addressed. In fact, the 9/11 Commission, another Warren Commission whitewash, you spent several pages talking about the creation of Al-Qaeda, which were Arabs who came from all over the Middle East to Afghanistan to fight the Soviet occupation. And never once in there they mentioned that the CIA had put them all together, just like they did the anti-Castro Cubans.
We're getting more reports since the 9/11 Commission issued its report than during that report.
Exactly.
I mean, now we're getting stuff out.
Exactly. In fact, this is what kills me is that I had a lot of this information in 2002, and I put it together in a book, had a big book contract in New York, and then all of a sudden they just said, no.
It's too hot to handle.
And it was too hot then, yeah. But now it's dribbling out. Now it's beginning to be too late to do anything about it. And now that we're caught, mired down in Iraq and still trying to figure out what's going on with everything, my thing is, you know, why can't journalists who can get onto these things, why isn't there an outlet where we can actually reach the majority of the American people? But you can't, because there's three or four corporations that control the mass media in this country.
And let's go to the phones.
And George, that's the key to it, the mass, okay?
Well, that's right, absolutely. It won't muffle us, Jim.
When was the last time that you recall hearing a national politician refer to the Republic.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
You haven't heard that in a long time.
It's been a long time.
That's because I don't think we have a Republic anymore. And that's why all you hear today is, well, we must defend democracy. We must protect democracy. Well, you know, democracy is not what we were given by the Founding Fathers. They gave us a democratic republic. Now, what's the difference? Well, democracy is ruled by the majority. And the most classic example of democracy in action is a lynch mob. And, you know, and nobody wants that. So we were given a democratic republic. And what's the difference? Well, under a democratic republic, you have a system of laws and checks and balances, which says that the guy has to have a fair trial, has to be represented by legal representation, has the right to confront his accusers and the evidence. And then if he's fairly squarely convicted and maybe even gets an appeal and that's turned down, then you can lynch him, okay? But we were started off as a nation of laws, as a lawful republic, and I'm sorry, it just seems to me that we've just kind of lost that.
Let's go to the phones, Jim. As promised, first-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Jim. This is Steve from Detroit.
Welcome, Steve.
My first question, I guess, is Alan Dulles was fired by Kennedy in 61. There was National Security Act 55, 56, and 57 that dissolved essentially was going to lead to for the CIA to be dissolved, lack of the word I'm looking for. But
yes, those memorandums were shifting responsibility from the CIA.
I think that they had an involvement in it if there was a conspiracy. And what do you think on that, Jim? And then one quick question, could have Tom Wilson in the Nigel Turner series, they were saying a shot was taken from the sewer, and the specials on TV said that there was no way he was in view. And from what I can make out of the Zapruder films, it seems apparent that a shot could have been gotten off from there. And I'll take it off the air.
Okay, yes. The memorandums that you mentioned were signed by Kennedy and were intended to shift power and responsibility away from the CIA and place it back into the Pentagon, where it probably more properly belonged. In fact, the New York Times reported that Kennedy had vowed to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and cast it to the winds. Even President Truman, who signed the National Security Act that created the CIA, later came to say, man, you know, maybe I made a mistake, basically. And then as far as the gunman in the sewer goes, the problem is there is no real evidence to show that that happened. But just for your interest, I actually myself have gotten down in that. It's not a sewer. It's just a storm drain. But you can climb down in there, and it does have that wide slit where the water runs in. And I've looked up, and from that position to the president's car in the middle of the street, you're only talking about 6 feet or so. I mean, it's definitely possible that something like that could have happened. But then I think that leads me to the main point, which is we don't know if that happened or not, because to this very day, there has never been an objective, truthful, in-depth investigation into the death of President Kennedy.
I got all excited when they were going to test the audio of the shots, and then they came up with something that really wasn't conclusive.
Right. Well, basically what happened there was that the Congress created the House Committee on Assassinations, and they had a executive director and a chief counsel who vowed they were going to do an honest investigation, and then before it was over with, there was a lot of squabbling and name-calling and withholding of funds, and those guys went away, and they put a man in who said that he was not going to look at any new evidence. He was simply going to check through scientific means to see if there's anything wrong with the old evidence, and they were all prepared to say it was Oswald with 3 shots, and that's it. except for this acoustical tape that's been mentioned, and that was made from the Dallas Police Dicta Belt. And on there, two separate sets of acoustical scientists said that at least one shot came from the grassy knoll, okay? But then they turned it over to the Justice Department and said, well, you need to investigate further, and the Justice Department declined to do so, but instead put together a committee from the National Academy of Sciences, and all they did was call into question the acoustical studies. And then that floated along for a while, just in controversy, and everybody forgot about it. And then a peer review group in Britain came back and said that the National Academy of Sciences were all wet and that their methodology was all wrong. And so, again, it's just mired in controversy, which I guess means that if you can afford to hire experts, you can prove anything or disprove anything you want to.
Absolutely. Stay with us. We'll come back, wrap up with... Okay, let's go to the phones now. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Mars on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Michael in Norfolk, Virginia.
Hi, Michael. Good to have you with us.
Hey, thank
Michael.
You. I will preface my remarks by saying that last night's program and tonight's program are two excellent examples of why, if the producers of Coast to Coast AM should decide to produce a daytime version of the show, it would also be the dominant talk show program in daytime radio as well. But to my question, and your very brilliant nighttime producer, Tom Danheiser, thought it was a good question. It is a question that goes to what I think is the Achilles heel of Jim Mars's position. And in a sense, the Achilles heel of what Coast to Coast AM has been over the last several years. And my question is this. I noticed, Jim, that you would not condemn the failure to stop the attack on Pearl Harbor. And the reason why you wouldn't do so is because you felt it was necessary to stop Japanese imperialism and German Nazism. But here's the Achilles heel to your position and the position of so many other guests that come on Coast to Coast AM who oppose the whole idea of globalization. My friends at the Council of Foreign Relations and the Bilderbergers and so many of the other groups that you target as the enemy are highly motivated men. And I think that the basis of their motivation is a good one. They want to prevent World War III. Now, you don't deny that there was a World War I and a World War II, and that the possibility of a third one exists there. But what you have failed to do with your parade of guests, and including tonight's guest, Jim Mars, who is an excellent, articulate man, one of the most articulate men in the history of modern communications. What you have failed to do is to produce a plan that would realistically deal with the threat for World War III and give us an alternative to what we are doing right now to try to avoid it.
Well, Jim, I don't know if you're the one to do that. Are you?
Let me. There are 2 points here. Number one, he has misrepresented my comments. What I said is that I'm not making any judgment on the decision to allow the Pearl Harbor attack because I could see the argument that it might have been necessary to stop Nazism and that. So I didn't say that I concurred with that decision. If you'll read my book, Rule by Secrecy, you'll find out the Japanese were goaded into attacking the United States, particularly when Roosevelt shut off their oil supplies in the summer of 1941, almost guaranteeing that they had to attack us. He also, under the guise of security, prevented any of our naval vessels from going into the northwestern Pacific, which guaranteed that they had a clear shot at Pearl Harbor without being detected by our Navy. the you have to go back and understand the motives of some of the people who are trying to run these various scenarios. And I noticed the gentleman said his fellow members of the Council on Foreign Relations. Let me be quick to point out that everybody who's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations is not some sinister conspirator, okay? But there are people, the Council on Foreign Relations is very much like the Freemasons. There's an outer circle and there's an inner circle. And people within the inner circle have their own game plan, and maybe they even delude themselves into think that what they're doing will prevent World War III. But what they're going for is globalization, the New World Order, one world economy, one world military, one world government. And my question back to the caller is that let's assume they achieve this goal and everything's run out of the United Nations building in New York. What is our guarantee that we won't get a new Hitler who will gain control over that system and therefore attain the age-old goal of ruling the world, and then with no free countries left to try to put a stop to this? Also, I'd also point out that the way to world peace, if that is indeed the game plan, is not through imperialism and imposing our will, the will of the United States, on other countries, and not informing these unions like the European Union and the North American Union that they're trying to form, but instead to bring out the technology that's been suppressed for all these years, produce the food and the clothing and the shelters so that everybody in the world can share in the abundance, and then take democracy back to the grassroots and let each community at local levels take care of their own problems. And if everyone was left alone, and if everyone had food, clothing, and shelter, and the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it's utopian sounding, but I don't believe there would be any World War III. And I think that if people were educated and given the chance to operate under a true freedom that most people want, to just live and be happy and take care of their families, and I think that that could be attained with the technology we have available today if it was allowed to be promoted out to all of the people in the world.
All right. Thanks for that response, Jim. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead. Thanks for holding, sir.
Yeah. This is Mike calling from Coralville, Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just listening last night's program and tonight about you're talking about the Kennedy conspiracy thing.
Yes,
and, of course, about different things of the government. On the History Channel here a while back, they had different scenarios on there. And they had a lady that had a film like the Magruder film, and I couldn't remember her name. But she was on there, and she had a film that she had took across the street from where Magruder was, and she said that she gave the film that a Secret Service or an agent of the Secret Service come over and confiscated the tape. Now, there was reports that probably that there was several other people that might have had something similar like that. Did any of these people that are on these conspiracy theories, and it's the same thing with the some of the stuff that Jackie Kennedy had written in her diary, that she might have had what she thought or wrote about what she knew might be involved in it, locked up, her papers are locked up for 40 years, and that's the same thing with all these government stuff that's in these archives. Isn't somebody, or can somebody get in to get these people to release this information so it's you know, brought out now, and why is it wasted for or waited till 40 years from now?
That's a good question.
Very good question, and I would simply point out that we keep talking about why do they keep it locked up? Why won't they tell us the truth? They is the federal government of the United States, and we pay their salary. We give them our tax money. They should be responsible to us, not us responsible to them.
They want us to die off, Jim, so that the next generation, who probably wouldn't even know about the Kennedy assassination, merely will say, oh.
Oh, so what? That's history, and I'm bored with history. Okay, that's true. Now, let me point out one quick other thing, though. He's talking about the people who had films and pictures confiscated, which is true. There was hundreds of more photographs and maybe films that were taken in Dealey Plaza of the assassination that were freely handed over to the FBI. I was there. I remember. They came on television and radio, and all the way into the summer of 1964, urging citizens who had photographs or films taken in Dealey Plaza to turn them over to the government as evidence so they could find out what happened to our president. And all those films and all those photographs have disappeared down that government black hole, and we've never seen them since.
But somebody has them somewhere, Jim.
Somebody's got them somewhere. And I'll tell you a quick story. The House, the Assassination Records Review Board contacted me and wanted a photograph that I have of myself dancing with on Jack Ruby's Carousel Club stage that was taken in October of 1963. A very young Jim Mars. Okay,
what were you doing there, Jim?
Well, I was a college kid, and you know that
all
was
right,
the place
right.
to go. Okay.
Did you remember?
It was the only place in that and the Collie Club were the only places in Dallas that there was any action going on.
Okay.
And let me hasten to point out that this was not like the nude bars of the day. It was actually more like vaudeville. They had a live band, and they had a master of ceremonies, and they had, I remember seeing a ventriloquist act there, and they had stand-up comedians, and yes, in between, the girls would come out and do a strip. But I assure you that you see more skin on Baywatch today than you did in Jack Ruby's Carousel.
Oh, well, now we add to the conspiracy, though, because now one of my favorite guests, Jim Mars, would frequent
there.
Jack Ruby's place. I mean,
oh, I met Jack Ruby. Yeah. Now, but here's the thing. I told him, well, what in the world, this Assassination Records Review Board? I said, why do you want my picture? That's not going to add to anything. And you know what they told me?
Mm-mm.
They said that they had gone to the FBI and asked them to turn over all of the photographs that the club photographer had taken to this Assassination Records Review Board. And the FBI said there were no such photographs because there was no club photographer in the Carousel Club, and they wanted my photograph, which was taken by the club photographer who would come around, snap your picture, and then sell it to you for a dollar. They wanted my picture so they could go back to the FBI and say, here is a photograph taken by the club photographer. Give us the photograph.
Yeah, he'd sell it.
That is the extent that they will drag their feet to not let this information out.
He'd sell it to you for a dollar or blackmail you for 20.
Yeah,
right?
Really.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi there. Let's see, I had the screener scratching his head for a few moments. Maybe I can make you understand. On his theory, I too believe that, of course, there wasn't only one shooter. But here's the deal. All the books I've read, Kennedy argued with his advisors about that he wanted the bubble down. They wanted the bubble to be put up, okay, on that car.
Right.
Right. Now, if he didn't have the bubble put up, just to ride, you know, in a regular car, because the waters they had tested were unfriendly in Texas. Okay, well, how convenient for all of those shooters that it just worked out to their plans.
Always does, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but I'm a mystery writer. This is a detail that just drives me nuts. It was just all too convenient. And if that bubble, to your guess, was up, would there, or if he just rode in a regular car, would they have been able to kill him? And if Johnson was involved, why would he put himself in the line of fire like that? And so something had to come out, some word or something.
Whoa. Johnson was not in the line of fire, per se.
No, he was two cars back.
He was two cars back.
Oh, okay.
You're thinking of John Connally,
yes,
who was the governor
right.
of Texas. Okay.
Right.
Okay, let me address this, okay? Number one, you're absolutely correct. If the bubble top had been on the car, it would have either stopped bullets or possibly deflected bullets. And you're absolutely right that it was Kennedy who said, I don't want the bubble top on the car. But why? How could they have known that he would have said that?
Right.
It's this simple.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Nixon was in Dallas. Richard Nixon ran against Kennedy in 1960. He was in Dallas the day of the assassination. He'd been there the whole week for a bottlers convention, along with Joan Crawford, who had assumed control of Pepsi Cola. And they were both quoted in the Dallas papers as saying, is making fun of all of the security that was being announced about Kennedy and saying, well, you know, our political positions are more correct than his, and we don't need all that protection. So they goaded Kennedy into saying, remove the top from the car. Plus, it was a beautiful fall day. It had rained that morning. But by about 10 o'clock in the morning, the Texas skies were clear blue. It was shirt sleeve weather. The sun was out. He was there on a goodwill visit. He wanted to be seen by the public. And so they knew basically and with this goading that he himself would insist on taking down the bubble top. They didn't have to worry about that protective top being on the car.
Wow. How lucky for them.
How lucky for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Well, only a few more moments to go here, Jim. Let's see if we have time for one more quick call. Go ahead. You've got about a minute.
Hi, this is Richard. I'm calling from the Armenian province of Glendale, California.
Hello there, Richard.
Hey, I wanted to give Jim just a quick couple of kudos first. I really, really appreciate where you're coming from, Jim, as far as your thoughts about what a nation state should be. I agree with you 100%. We need to take care of people, and we need to allow people to take care of themselves. And if the government can't do that, then it serves absolutely no purpose at all. And I cannot wait for your show on the Discovery Channel. I am so looking forward to that. I was just delighted to hear about that. But I'd like to get to flying saucers. I just saw that video you guys got on your website of the Bavarian flying saucer. And that is a good-looking video. And I was wondering, Jim, if you've had a chance to see that and if you know at what stage the analysis of that video is at this point.
No, I do not at this point. But I think the thing that we need to leave the show on is that, in order for us to truly consider ourselves free people, we have to be free. And that means we have to have access to the information about Kennedy assassination, 9/11, the UFOs, so that we as free citizens can make up our own minds about what we want to do about this stuff and instruct our elected officials to do so. I think the time has passed where we have to all look towards the federal government as some sort of a daddy figure who will take everything and take charge of everything and tell us how to live our lives.
Very good. Jim, the website, of course, jimmars.com. All your books, are they available through your website?
Yes. Plus, most of them are, in fact, all of them, as far as I know, are available through any bookstore. And again, you can also get the Secrets of Redgate at secretsofredgate.com.
Very good. Jim, thank you. I appreciate you being on the program this week.
This is great, George. Look forward to talking with you again sometime.
Absolutely. Jim Mars, good investigative reporter, isn't he?